You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Paul goes to Corinth, Acts 18, verse 1. After this, Paul left Athens, that was last week, and he went to Corinth, Greece. Corinth. Maybe if you're a Bible reader, you've read 1 and 2 Corinthians. That's why these letters were written, because Paul planted this church. We zoom in, you see here that the city, it looks like an island. It's not really an island. It's a peninsula. And there's a little isthmus. It's basically a strait of land that comes off the island onto the mainland of Greece. The population of Corinth was anywhere from 100,000 to 700,000 people. Rome was 1 million. Corinth is 700,000. Why, my God, why would this city be so big? Three reasons. Location, location, location. This city was on that isthmus, that basically that land tract right here. And if you were a mariner and you were trying to bring your boat through, you had to go all the way around the Peloponnese to the south, and it was a dangerous voyage. Or you could go through in between Greece and mainland Corinth, Greece here, and then you could either drop your materials, right? All the stuff that you brought, you could just sell it right there in Greece, Corinth. Or you could slide your boat across that little narrow 3 miles to get to the other side of the isthmus to the Aegean, and then you could take off and do whatever sailors did in the first century. Today, we don't have this issue to decide whether we want to go all the way around the Peloponnese or across that little tract of land, because in 1893, they dug a canal. So now they can just go straight through. Not so then. Back during this time, this made Corinth big. Big in every way. They were just a big, booming city. They were successful. They were rich. Strabo calls Corinth always great and wealthy. Prosperous. Thucydides calls them rich. They were stinking rich. Everyone came through here. All the trade, all the commerce, all of it. Second, because everyone had so much money, and because this was a place that you would hang out, they wanted entertainment. So that brought them to sports. And the Isthmian Games were second only to the Olympics. However, the Olympics were once every 4 years. The Isthmian Games were ratcheted up a little bit more to be every 2 years. They were like the Olympics on steroids. And they had a big 18,000-person amphitheater, a 3,000-person concert hall, and they did everything at the Isthmian Games. Long-distance running, which I've never understood why people are into that. They were into that back then. Some of you are into that today. Sprints, they did sprints back then, boxing, wrestling, chariot races, they did chariot races back then. You think that's just for movies? No. Paul, of course, if you read his correspondence with the Corinthians, mentions many of these games. And they were known for sex. Sex. Sailors at sea for weeks, months, coming into port, lots of money. Lonely, and they're there, and what do? They're looking for girls. Well, Strabo, the Greek geographer, said that there were 1,000 priestesses in the temple of Aphrodite. What does he mean by priestesses, however? This word, hierodoulos, slave, hiero, sacred. 1,000 sacred slaves in Corinth, Greece. Where? At this temple to Aphrodite. So these young girls, sex trafficked, to be worshiping. Of course, Aphrodite was a fertility deity, fertility goddess. So if they could get sex going in the temple, this would mean that Aphrodite would want to bless the crops and everything else happening in Corinth. Plutarch, the first century biographer, said that Corinth had a, quote, great army of prostitutes. Wow. Another playwright, Aristophanes, coined the term Corinthianize. Corinthianize. He took a proper noun and he turned it into a verb to describe what? To describe sexual intercourse outside of marriage. I had a friend back in high school. Very clumsy, okay? Everything he did, clumsy. Stumbling over himself, tripping over his feet, dropping things, saying things at the wrong time, to the point where we named clumsy actions after my friend, Derek. So we'd be like, you really Derek'd that the other night, you know? Or you've been really Derek'ing things lately. Or we'd be at a pep assembly, and a cheerleader would do a back handstand flip or whatever and land on her head or whatever. And we'd be like, she really Derek'd that. You know what I mean? We weren't good kids, but that's what we did. Everything was Derek'd. We turned his proper noun name into a verb. They turned the name of the city into how to have sex. Corinthianize. Just filthy, slimy. Ugh. Athenaeus, 2nd century rhetorician, referred to the patron goddess Aphrodite as Aphrodite of the beautiful buttocks, which to me reminds me of how people objectify celebrities today, where celebrities have to wear things that are very revealing, skin tight. It's all about, you know, beauty and the way that the celebrity looks. It makes me think of, you know, Benson Boone, for example. You know what I mean? Like, ladies, please. He's not just a pretty face with a mustache and a mullet, all right? The guy is the voice of an angel. You wanted to see it again, didn't you? All right, you can see it again. It's fine. All right. Athenaeus, he says, whenever the city praised Aphrodite in matters of grave importance, they invite as many prostitutes as possible to join in their petitions. So sex, sophistry, was the next thing that was popular in Corinth. What is this? Sophists, maybe you recognize that term. Philosophy, the love of Sophia, wisdom. So sophists were known as being wise men. But they weren't really wise. They were professional rhetoricians, professional public speakers, professional debaters, and they would speak for a cost, similar to podcasts today. It isn't that the person is really equipped to speak on any subject necessarily. We don't know. What are their credentials? We don't know. But they're erudite, well-spoken. They're able to, you know, have the gift of gab. And they're able to speak. And so these people would be hired to argue, to speak, and to do whatever in the city of Corinth. Here's what's interesting about Corinth, Greece. They were rich out of their minds. They were highly sexualized. They were, you know, entertained to death. However, they were also spiritually interested. And that's what we're going to read about here tonight. Paul went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus. He had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla. Why? Why did he come from Italy to Corinth? Because Claudius the emperor had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. Come on. You don't just have an edict that just kicks out all of the Jews in Rome. How would you even begin to do that? Where do you even start doing something like that? Well, right here, Suetonius, the Roman historian, mentions the same event. He says, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbance at the instigation of who? Crestus. Crestus. Most scholars, critic or Christian, believe that Crestus is an aberration. It's a misspelling of the Latin rendering Christus. Christus. So this is referring to people debating so much, so frequently over Christ in Rome that Claudius didn't know what was going on, and he just said, get out, everybody out. And all of these Jewish people were kicked out of the city of Rome. He expelled them from the city. This was in AD 49. Claudius became emperor in AD 41, and he reigned to 54. Dyslexic. All right, so 41 to 54. Yeah. So there it is. Lines right up. So if they were expelled in AD 49, that would put this when? What time? Well, we read, Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Rabbis needed to have a trade in addition to being able to teach the Bible. Paul's trade was tent making. And when he writes his correspondence with the Corinthians, he talks about how when he was there, he worked with his hands. Lines right up with what we're reading here in the book of Acts. Every Sabbath, Paul reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, so up until this point, he's working with his hands, right? Paul, the equivalent of a double PhD. Paul, you know, maverick church planter. Paul, the guy that you'd think you'd have at the very front of every church planting movement in the time. He's sitting there working a job as a tradesman. But when Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. What changed? According to the letters, Timothy and Silas brought a financial gift to Paul. From whom? From the Philippians, from the Thessalonians, from the Bereans, from all those churches from earlier, so that he wouldn't have to work. And what a gift that would be to the church in Corinth. But when they opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and he said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent of it. For from now on, I will go to the Gentiles. So he's like, I'm done explaining this to you. However, Paul left the synagogue, and where did he go? Next door. Like, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, but I'm going to go 8 steps over there, and I'm going to hang out with this guy, Dishus Justus, a worshiper of God. So that must have been very awkward first thing in the morning when you see each other. Paul just said the blood's on our heads and everything, and now he's right there. Crispus, the synagogue leader, and his entire household believed in the Lord. Paul mentions Crispus when he writes his letter to the Corinthians. So again, Acts and the letters are lining up like a hand in a glove. And Paul is one who is reaching these people like crazy. The synagogue leader comes to faith in Jesus. Many of the Corinthians who heard Paul believed, and they were baptized. So this must have been a pretty sizable movement. And then we get this in verse 9. One night the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision. This is Jesus. Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you. No one is going to attack you. No one is going to harm you because I have many people in this city. Why would Jesus need to open up with the words, don't be afraid? Paul must have been scared. Scared to be in the city. Scared that he just took a beating in Philippi. Scared that he just left Thessalonica and they were going to lynch him. Berea, they were going to lynch him. Athens, he gets out of there. Now he's here. And there's already problems. It's a big movement. And Paul just must have been feeling out of it. So Jesus, first thing, don't be afraid. But why? Why? Well, he says, keep on speaking and do not be silent. So that's what he should do. But why shouldn't he be afraid? Because I'm with you. That's why. You know, we can go through quite a bit if we know that God's with us. If we know God is there, yeah, the fear can get pretty high. But knowing God's behind us, God is for us, who can be against us? And then he gives this personal promise to Paul. No one is going to harm you. Whoa, that must have felt, he must have been elated after hearing that. Remember all the beatings, the stonings he's taken? It's bad, really bad. Read the list in 2 Corinthians 11 sometime. Real bad. Shipwrecks, whippings, beatings, hungry, thirsty, everything. I mean, persecuted, worried. And now Jesus says, you're in Corinth. You know, this is in the middle of, you know, Las Vegas on steroids and PCP, all right? And I got you in there, and no one is going to be able to harm you or attack you. Just to feel that protective bubble from Jesus, knowing I can't be touched. Well, Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and a half, teaching them the word of God. This must have really lifted his spirits, huh? While Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews of Corinth made a united attack on Paul and brought him to the place of judgment. Gallio, proconsul meaning like the leader, kind of like the governor in this region. These religious people bring Paul before Gallio. Who is this guy? We know him from history. He's the brother of Seneca the philosopher. I don't know if you've ever read any Seneca in any of your courses. He was known for being virulently anti-Semitic. Translation, he hated the Jews. And here he is in Corinth, Greece, and these Jews come to speak to him about Paul. Yeah. And he ruled in Corinth for no longer than 2 years. From May of AD 51, sometime into AD 52, this becomes a real benchmark for how we know the chronology in Acts. Because we have the Delphi inscription, which mentions the date of Gallio taking over in Corinth in AD 51. Remember what I said earlier? Claudius kicked all of the Jews out of Rome in AD 49. Aquila and Priscilla, they're there in Corinth. They're like, we got kicked out of Rome. Now we're reading, it's AD 51. Later, you'll pick up the book of Romans tonight before you go to bed. And you'll read the whole thing, all right, all 16 chapters. And you'll get to the end, and you'll get to verse 3 of chapter 16. And it'll say, Paul writing to Aquila and Priscilla in Rome. Now, hold on a second. They were kicked out of Rome by Claudius. It's AD 51. They're in Corinth. Then in AD 57, they're back in Rome. What is it? What gives? Claudius died in AD 54. When he did, the edict was rescinded. All of the Jews flooded back into Rome just in time for Paul to write to Aquila and Priscilla. Guys, to forge that, to fake that many different books, Acts, Romans, Corinthians, Suetonius, we're putting it all together and it's all lining up chronologically, perfectly. Anyways, Gallio. This man, Paul, the mob charged, is persuading people to worship God in ways contrary to the law. Which law? Roman law or Hebraic law? Under the Roman law, the Jewish people could worship freely. The Romans had no issue if you wanted to worship Jesus. They didn't care. What they cared about is if you worshiped only Jesus. That was the big issue in the first century, as well as the subsequent centuries. To say Jesus is the only way, the only truth, and the only life, no one can get to the Father except through him, that's where the Romans took issue. The Jews, however, they had political amnesty. They could have a legal religion under Rome, and they could worship only Yahweh. The Romans just said, we saw the Maccabean revolt. We don't want to redo that. You guys can worship God. We don't care. Just pay taxes. And the Jews said, all right. And that was a big issue at this time. All that being the case, these religious people were saying, see Paul, see Timothy, see Silas, they're not one of us. So they're telling people to go against God in ways contrary to the law. And there's a certain ambiguity. Is it Roman law or Jewish law or both? Either way, Paul is in deep trouble. Then again, Jesus said, no one will attack you or harm you in this city. Wonder how this story is going to turn out. Just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to them, if you Jews, remember the anti-Semitism, he hates Jewish people, if you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime even, it would be reasonable for me to listen. But this involves questions about words and names and your own law. Settle the matter yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things. So he drove them away from the Bema seat, the judgment seat. Then the crowd there turned on who? Sosthenes, the synagogue leader. So big lynch mob. They're like, we're here to rough somebody up. And they're like, well, is it Paul? No. Gallio is cool with him. So who can we rough up? We're here to fight. Sosthenes was the guy who failed. So they're like, well, let's beat him bloody. They beat him in front of Gallio, and Gallio shows no concern whatsoever. Anti-Semitic. There it is again. Meanwhile, Paul stayed in Corinth for some time. Whatever happened to that guy, Sosthenes, anyways? This guy trying to be an enemy of Paul and Christianity, and he shows up and he says, Paul's the one going contrary to the law, but it backfires. He's the one who ends up getting beaten up. We read months later in Paul's first letter to the Corinthians these words. Chapter 1, verse 1. This letter is from Paul, chosen by the will of God to be an apostle of Christ Jesus, and from our brother Sosthenes. It's got to be the same guy. You don't introduce the letter unless everybody in that community knows who this is. It's our guy. The synagogue leader, he gets beaten up. It backfires. And there he is, beaten up on the ground. Gallio is just like, disgusted. People leave. And then the image, in my mind at least, is Paul coming up to this man saying, I've got a message that you need to hear about. He befriends him. He loves him, takes care of him, leads him to Christ, and he becomes a fellow believer. Sosthenes, what a message there. Well, as we wrap up here tonight, how did God encourage Paul to persevere in this rough and tumble Corinthian culture? And by way of a fact, how should we be encouraged to deal with our individual culture? Well, to be sure, Paul was very worried. When he walked in there, he admitted as such in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 3. He said, when I came to you in weakness and with great fear and trembling. Paul, somebody who wasn't scared of anything or anybody, saying, not Corinth. When I came to Corinth, I was trembling, great fear, scared out of my mind. And when Timothy gets sent there, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 16, don't scare him when he shows up. Don't scare Timothy. And when Jesus shows up, what are the first words out of his mouth? Don't be afraid. He must have been scared. What did God do to encourage Paul? Maybe you're here and you're feeling discouraged. It just doesn't seem like anything is going well. You feel afraid. You feel timid. And you're like, is this always going to be this way? Paul was feeling that way. Took some licks, got beaten up, persecuted, everything. And even though people were coming to faith, it's like he was still dealing with fear. What is it that turned things around? Paul must have been thinking to himself, you know, nobody in a town like this could possibly be spiritually interested. Corinth, Greece, 1,000 sacred slave prostitutes, you know, gladiatorial games, blood, murder, just everything under the sun. People here would be interested in Christ. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing about hedonism. You know what that word means, right? Living for pleasure. Just trying to do anything you can to feel good all the time. It feels good, you know, otherwise they wouldn't call it hedonism. They call it something else. But it feels good for a time. Modern psychologists refer to this as the hedonic treadmill, that you need to run faster and faster and faster to keep up with the amount of pleasure that you used to receive for the same action. Hedonism leaves you with just a handful of ashes, empty. It's like you did everything that you wanted. You went there. You did it. You did it again. You did it more. Then you got into experiences you never thought you would. And then you realize, I'm still me. I'm still empty. There's nothing here. This is all a mirage. And meanwhile, God, through Jesus, is saying, I have many people in this city. Yeah, I know from your vantage points, it doesn't look like that. From mine, lots of people here. Many people are just spiritually starving. That if they just heard about this message of love and forgiveness from Jesus, they'd believe it. As a result, many came to faith in Christ, and that's why, you know, Paul, who had ants in his pants, you know, he couldn't stay in any one place for too long. He stays there for a couple years. Same thing is true for us. I don't know if we're as bad as Corinth. Close. We're close, man. The more you read, the more you study on this, you go, wow, we are. Our culture today, it is velocitized. Like when you're on the highway, you go 60 miles an hour. And you're like, I don't want to be an old lady here, you know. So you get up to 80 miles an hour. Ooh, man, now we're really moving. But then 80 starts to feel like 60. So you get up to 85, 90, you know. Okay, now we're moving. But see, that feels like 80. And on it goes until it just nothing feels normal. And that is the way our culture has really shifted. We're moving at a breakneck speed. And you all, I guess we all, are the social experiment. And we don't know what the outcome is going to be yet. Think about this. Loneliness on campus, 84,000 students. So that's a huge sample size, right? 2025. What percentage of students, either in a college or a university, felt lonely, reported loneliness? 6 out of 10 college students. This is supposed to be the time where it's like, you know, I get to have the college experience. Everything's going to be great. You know, like all my friends are going to be here and I can skip class if I feel like it and I get to make friends and it's like the time of my life. And 6 out of 10 people are saying, I'm lonely. Well, yeah, but we all feel lonely sometimes. Hold on. How about this? Loneliness resulted in, quote, increased odds of marijuana, stimulant, and opioid misuse. That's very precise language in a scientific journal. They're not even just saying they smoke weed. They're saying marijuana misuse. Basically, they're using it to cope. So whatever this is serious, serious loneliness. What about hookups, sex on college campus over the last 3 months? What percentage of people that got into a hookup with somebody else reported one negative impact from that hookup? Let me back up. When I read this study, they opened up by saying, you know, people that engage in hookup culture share that it increases positivity, increases self-esteem, increases pleasure, and increases happiness. And I was going, duh, yeah. Why do you go out and get laid? Oh, because it's so depressing. You know what I mean? Like, no, No, of course people go out and have sex because it's self-esteem and it's fun and it feels good. Like nobody does it because it's awful, right? So obviously that's why people have sex. They've been doing that for, 100,000 years. Here's the issue. What about this? What percentage got into one of these casual hookups, most of which were with friends, people they knew, not like some random stranger? And they reported one negative impact, 8 out of 10. Looked at that and said, that's not what it was supposed to be. What did they share? Regret. Half of them looked back and they said, I regret that. Wish I never did that. Sexually, quote, unsatisfied or unfulfilled. Not in the existentialist sense, like, oh, I feel so unfulfilled. What they mean is, I had sex and the sex wasn't good. That's what they mean. The hookup went too far. I didn't like it. Something, the boundaries were crossed, moral boundaries. I felt embarrassed. I felt shame, or I felt lonelier than before. How about that? What about screen use? You go, well, okay, I'm not going to get into opioids and, marijuana and hooking up with anything with, two legs walking down the street. I'm not going to do that. I'm not some kind of a wild person. I'm just going to be on my screen, just relaxing, looking at videos and, okay, how about this? No screen use, which I don't even know how they find these people. Might as well look for a four-leaf clover at this point. No screen use would be the benchmark. People who watch their screens 5 hours or more per day, which is below average. The average is 7 hours and 16 minutes per day, not including your job, not including school. 5.5 hours is minimal by comparison to the average. With me? So somebody who's like, no, I don't actually have a phone. I don't even really look at a screen. I don't do that. Compared to the one who's like 5.5 hours or 5 hours or more per day, 3 times more depressed. In a world, in a culture where depression and everything else is just completely off the reservation. It is so bad. And here we are, amusing ourselves to death. Not looking at people in the eye, no social skills, not knowing what's going on in other people's lives, but we're up to speed on every, tweet or, every video, every, reel and everything else. Man, oh man, came across this recently. A buddy of mine sent this to me. Reddit, this is where you get all the, the best sources of truth on the internet. It's a personal opinion. This young woman asked this question, is it lonelier? Is it lonelier, OSU campus? Hey, so I'm a first year commuter student. Obviously I understand commuter life is different and less social, but outside of that, I feel like the campus is so individual and alone. Like everyone is there, but everyone has headphones or is on their phones. Feels like we're all existing there next to each other instead of with each other. I don't know. Is it just me? Are all universities like this, or is it just OSU? Thanks. Crazy plant lover, 24. Someone who lives on OSU campus, it's not just lonely for commuters. I 100% agree that people are on their phones way too much. Everyone seems afraid of making real connections in person, and honestly, it's sad. Another person says, it's so lonely out here. Glad to know I'm not the only one on this because I used to think I'm the problem. While I still think I have to work on my anxiety problems, people on campus just don't help. I tried to get out of my comfort zone and go to an event by myself. It was so awkward because nobody welcomed me or spoke to me. They were all laughing with each other since they're friends. It's so obvious I'm new and trying to connect, but they just had me stand there by myself. It's really hard making friends out here, especially with someone like me who's anxious and introverted. Some people would look at that and say, get over it. Why don't you just go join a club? Why don't you just do something with your life? Maybe it's your fault after all. I don't know. I don't know. We all inhabit this space. We see people. Yeah, most people, they don't make eye contact. They don't talk. It starts to get kind of weird. We can't have a conversation without a phone out, without getting, you know, stoned, without getting drunk. We can't really communicate. What is that? That is a sub-relational, subhuman state. And it's no wonder that when you don't know how to relate with other people, things break down. Sex breaks down, friendships break down, everything breaks down when you lose this. The question is, how do you gain it? Let me just say this. It's not a myth. If you're here tonight and you're saying, you know, I've always wondered, is there a place where there's real love? Like people really do care. Like they're really trying. I know they're not going to be perfect, you know. Are they trying? Do they care? Where we really love each other, where we stick together. It's true. It's real. In the body of Christ, in the Christian community, you can experience real love the way that God designed. So if you're here tonight, you are in the right place. I know it can feel like a moral wasteland out there where everyone's trying to take, pull from each other. Everyone's in their little groups, you know, bifurcated from one another. And you're feeling like, what's wrong with me? Nothing. Nothing. What you need to do is develop real relationships based on God. And when you get God in the center, you see this lights right up. It's unbelievable. Wonder if Paul was thinking to himself, I'm all alone in this work. He felt that way in Athens, remember? He was all alone. Here, Jesus speaks to him, I am with you. Now, was it that Paul was an amnesiac and he just really didn't remember that? Like, huh, you're with me. Forgot about that. Or was it that he knew that, but he needed to hear it again? You're with me. And then Jesus reminds him, yeah, and I sent you two new friends, Aquila and Priscilla, a couple that you're going to be with for your whole ministry. They're going to be there with you. And two old friends, Silas and Timothy. I sent them to you as well, Paul. You're not alone. You're not by yourself. Oh, and by the way, all those people that you led to faith in Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea, they sent you a huge check. You don't have to work. You can just do full-time preaching, teaching, leadership. And I wonder if Paul began to connect the dots going, whoa, I thought I was all alone. God's here. Timothy's here. Silas, Aquila, Priscilla. And then all these churches. God, that must have meant so much to him. Seems to me that when you're in a situation where you're in a rough culture, you start to feel like I'm the only one. Nobody really shares any of these convictions but me. Not true. It's not true. It's not even true. And even if it was true, would you rather be with the 99% that are in the wrong or with the 1% that's in the right? Truth is not measured by a vote. Truth is either true or it's false. So, no, you're not alone. And finally, I wonder if Paul was scared of being hurt once again, which is why Jesus promises him, you're not going to get beaten up. You're not going to get whipped. You're not going to get slapped around, persecuted. You're not going to get hurt. And I wonder if there's people here who feel that way as well. You've been hurt. Maybe not a whipping or a beating or anything like that, but you put yourself out there, you tried, and bam, you got hit. You got lashed at. And sometimes these, you know, verbal lashings can be pretty bad. Well, if you feel like you're in danger, but Jesus says no one will harm you, are you in danger? Well, I know that the theologically correct answer is no. No, you're not in any danger. If you feel one way, okay, but God says just the opposite, which one of you is in the right? Jesus here is saying, my promises are real. Don't let how you feel control what it is that you do. Paul, I know you're afraid. Keep on speaking. Keep on teaching. Don't stop. I've got so many people in this city. Don't quit. Don't quit. Persevere. Push through. Don't stop. Don't let up. Don't quit. But I feel a certain way. And Jesus is saying, I know. I know you're afraid, but I'm with you. I've sent other people to be with you. People here need to hear this. And in the end of the day, no harm is going to befall you. I wonder if we need to hear that as well, that God is with us, that we have way more promises than just this, and God's going to see us through to the end.